The Legislative Commission on Planning Fiscal Policy will come to order. Hope everybody had a good Labor Day weekend. We today are going to try to be done for sure by noonish, if not earlier. And we have four items. We want to talk about cash flow, possibility of short-term borrowing, Medicaid FMAP, and other federal grants that are in the potential offing. Welcome, Commissioner. Good to see you.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. Mr. Chairman, it's been so long since the full group has met. I'm used to you and Representative Carlson and the smaller group.
They all missed it. All the members missed it, so we went back to the larger group.
It's our own secret. Mr. Chairman, what we're going to do, our presentation on cash flow encompasses the discussion on short-term borrowing as well as FMAP.
Okay, that's
so
fine.
I think it's our intent to cover all three of those issues. The governor has decided to accept the FMAP money, and we sent in our application for it this morning. Oh. So our numbers that you have before you reflect the state's receipt of the $260 million of FMAP money. The other point I want to just touch on before I turn it over to Ms. Dibdahl, not much has changed. You asked about short-term borrowing. Not much has changed on the overall terms of the arrangement we discussed at our last meeting. We are hoping to finalize our negotiations with U.S. Bank by the 17th of September and then actually close by September 20th. With U.S. Bank. Other than that, there is no new information that we can provide other than what we had talked about before. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Dibdahl, our state budget director, and she is going to walk through the sheet that has cash balances on August 31st, 2010.
Mr. Chair and Committee, Kristen Dibdahl for the record. What you have before you is the cash balance in the statutory general fund as of August 31st. So you can see that we had $873 million in the statutory general fund. We are running about $100 million above forecast year to date, and that's from a cash perspective above forecast. The first column, balance without actions, the way to think about that is that that's the true balance in each of these funds before factoring in the transfers and the interfund borrowing we've had to do. So you can see that the general fund would be $736 million in the red if we weren't able to borrow from other funds within the statutory general fund. The next column over shows where we have done formal transfers from the Special Revenue Fund, the Healthcare Access Fund, and MNSCU's fund to help support the general fund in terms of cash needs in the general fund. We've also had to borrow $36 million. I'm moving my way across the page here. We've had to borrow $36 million from the overall pool of cash within the statutory general fund. And then the last column is the daily managed balance. So right now, the Special Revenue Fund actually has $64 million in it, Healthcare Access Fund $16 million, MNSCU at $189, et cetera. Any questions on that before I...
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, I noticed that you have a kind of a running chart on the statutory general fund. Mm-hmm. Do you have such a chart, or I don't care if it's a chart or a spreadsheet, on just what the general fund is? I see that your general fund is $736 million, but you have a chart on daily or monthly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, I don't have copies available, but we certainly have that information.
Yeah,
we
that's extremely that. Important for us, I think, to see what the monthly would be.
Yep.
As well. Could you provide that to us?
Absolutely.
Thanks,
Mr.
Chair.
Today that we can copy or not?
We don't have it today, but we can get it to you.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, so I understand these columns correctly, then the Minsky General Fund, you took 350, so they will have remaining 189?
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, that's correct.
Because I had heard that you might be taking them down to 100.
That is correct. Over the last month or so, we've had several discussions with them, and we actually have a formal agreement now where both of us, MMB and Minsky, regard that $100 million level as ample cash balances to manage any risk they would have in terms of their tuition payments, in terms of in terms of the payments that they need to make. So I have a letter from Minsky. We can share that with you as well.
So, and you referenced, Mr. Chairman, the date of August 31st. These numbers then in that daily managed balance will be changing, with at least Minsky will be dropping another $89 million in terms of the cash that they will have.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, that's correct. As our cash needs increase, we expect to take another $89 million from Minsky.
And Mr. Chairman, I may ask later then what that means as a practical matter for their management, but I just wanted to make sure I understood that this was a temporary column then.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Fetters.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dibdahl, on the Minsky General Fund then, if there's $100 million balance, when will that $100 million be depleted, or when will that go into deficit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, are you asking when will that be repaid?
No, Ms. Chairman, Ms. Dibdahl. If I'm assuming that they had a $539 million balance because of their cash flow needs. If we take that down to $100 million, will they be able to go through the rest of the biennium at that level, or will that need to be repaid to them before the end of the biennium?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, we have an agreement with Minsky that $100 million is adequate in terms of a cash balance in order for them to meet all of their obligations through the rest of the biennium. So we would expect to repay that full amount by the end of the year.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dibdahl, in the all other funds, is that full $640 million available for interfund borrowing, or is some of that off limits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, it's available in the sense that we are able to access all funds in the statutory general fund. But we have to be aware of what the needs are in each of those funds in terms of making payments.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, those are dozens and dozens and dozens of very small accounts. And when we transfer money from a fund to the statutory general fund into the general fund, we always make sure that on the big funds, the ones that are easily manageable, that their needs are met. It gets a little harder with the smaller funds, is what we're trying to say. But the money is available.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. But I'm sure that each and every one of these dozens and dozens of smaller funds have a baseline, much like Minsky. Is that not correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was there borrowing within the general fund, or does the transfer within the general fund include withholding funds from school districts regarding that come from their fund balance?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, we have not delayed yet. We anticipate doing that beginning September 15th, and I plan to outline that on the next chart. So these numbers here don't reflect that action yet.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I want to follow up a little bit with what Representative Biskin said. I have a list of the those other funds, and some of them are, you know, $15 million or $27 million or $28 million. But like the snowmobile account and the all-terrain vehicle account, is there a baseline that they have to meet their obligations? Because many of these accounts are in the Department of Natural Resources account and other accounts. And some of them, I'm sure, may be game and fish funds and so forth that are coming in. Do we have a baseline of how much is actually needed in the snowmobile account come wintertime to be able to maintain, or can you take all their balance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, the way to think about that $36 million is that we're really borrowing from the entire pool of available cash in the statutory general fund. We're not specifically transferring money from the snowmobile account and putting it into the general fund. As Commissioner Hansen said, there are 70-plus smaller funds that make up that all-other fund category. So what we're doing is just borrowing from the available cash we have in the entire statutory general fund, and then we're monitoring the overall level on a daily basis of the statutory general fund and maintaining that level above $400 million.
Well, Mr. Chair, could I pursue this just then on a global basis? Since you're going to be borrowing from the funds, so what is the minimum amount that all those funds need in order for them to operate?
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, we believe that number is around $200 million of the $400 million in our minimum working capital target for the statutory general fund would be $400 million, and about $200 million of that we would say would be the all other funds amount.
On this cash balance, so other than on the daily managed balance side, other than the additional 89 from MinSQ, you're going to leave the 64 and the 16 there? You're not going to balance further? You're not going to borrow further there?
No, Mr. Chair.
How about out of the 604?
Mr. Chair, we probably will need to borrow more from the all other category.
How much?
Likely down to the $200 million mark, so that might be as much as $400 million.
404 more. Okay. Thank you.
One more thing.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, do all those funds have to be repaid back by June 30th?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, are you talking about the four major funds there?
Well, the all other funds.
Funds.
Yeah, everything. Yeah. I know schools are May 30th, but the other ones are June 30th, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, we're not actually administratively transferring money back and forth from all of these smaller funds. So there wouldn't be a repayment because we haven't formally borrowed from them. We're borrowing from the available cash pool, if that makes sense.
Well, Mr. Chair, it makes sense, but on a global basis, I guess. But it would be nice to know where you're getting the money from. I understand it's more work.
Well, you said you're going to give month by month, so it should show both borrowing and putting back in the fund, right?
Well, Mr. Chair, if the question is about all of these other funds, the 70 smaller funds, we're not actually administratively transferring money from each of those small funds into the general fund. So the question about repayment, those funds will have their full access to their full fund balance, even though we're borrowing the available cash we have in the statutory general fund pool. So there's no...
Madam Speaker.
Ms. Dibdahl, walk us through functionally how this is working, because at some point, if, say, all 70 funds needed their access to this. There's somebody that's not going to have access to this money if they all needed it at once. Isn't that correct? Isn't that the nature of borrowing the money from other funds?
Mr. Chair, Madam Speaker, that's true. However, we are monitoring that available cash balance at $200 million. So we'll never go below $200 million. And that way we can ensure that in those smaller funds, we will always have enough cash on hand to pay whatever bills we need to.
So, Ms. Dibdahl, you're essentially the administration has made a decision to play roulette. And on any given day, hypothetically, if all 70 funds needed access to the money, there would not be money there for all 70 funds. But on any given day, it's probably one or two funds that need access to the money, and therefore they're going to be fine because you're cash flowing it with enough that it'll be available. But to say that you're not, to one specific fund, I get what you're saying, but it's really semantics.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, we're not playing roulette. The reason we are taking out a short-term borrowing option in case we need it is to make sure, as I've stated here over the last year, our obligations are going to be met. We are talking about a pool of money, and we're grabbing some of that before we allocate it to the actual funds. It's just administratively easier for us than to go through 100 funds and making individual edits. Now, we can provide a list of those funds for you and what the balances are and make that available to you and your staff. It's more of an administrative maneuver on our part, but I want to emphasize, as I have all along, the reason we took out the short-term or we're finalizing the short-term borrowing option is to make sure that all of our obligations, including the snowmobile fund, will be met.
But, Commissioner, it would be true that if all 70 funds on one particular day needed access to a significant amount of money, it may not be available under this scenario based on what we were being told.
Then we would go to the borrowing. But they would. The snowmobile, that's just using that because Representative Solberg mentioned it. If we had to, we would go to the short-term account. Up to $600 million is what we have, and we would access that. But these funds would have the money.
So the borrowing point is before the money is deposited in these accounts, then? Is that what you're saying?
That's how I understand it. It's a fairly technical.
So I guess the question is, what is in these accounts today? And then after this process starts, is there really any impact on the accounts? I think that's the question.
Those are good questions. And this is, we're all becoming experts on cash flow and cash management at this time. But we can provide that information.
Mr. Chair, Madam Speaker, I thought I'd just mention also that we are literally monitoring cash in each of these funds on a daily basis. We have a joint process with our general accounting unit, with our budget operations staff, Charlie Bielek and folks, where we're looking at our end of session forecast, what our working forecast is given administrative actions, and then monitoring actual balances on a daily basis. And so we are very well aware when there are large payments. We need to know about them, and we have a really good relationship now with agencies in understanding what payments are going out the door and which ones will have a significant impact.
We have the website. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So do we know when these funds get paid back and we're not borrowing from them anymore, so that we don't have to be keeping track on a daily basis of what their needs are?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we expect, for example, with the Health Care Access Fund, that we will need to borrow from that fund throughout the fiscal year. And that fund probably won't be repaid completely until the end of the fiscal year. But again, we are monitoring all the payment requirements in that fund, and DHS is telling us, you know, we have a $7 million payment going out in 2 weeks. So we're making sure there's enough cash in that fund to meet all of our obligations. But in terms of full repayment, we don't expect that to occur till the end of the fiscal year.
But it will occur at that time?
Correct.
And you will not be borrowing from it after that time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, depending on the budget situation and what the outlook is for next year, we may need to borrow from the Healthcare Access Fund again next year. We did last year. We did the year before. I would expect we would have to do so next year as well, depending on the budget.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one comment, and that is that we worked pretty hard last year to make sure the Healthcare Access Fund would be in balance, and we did that so that it would have the money it needs to meet the needs of the individuals who rely on that fund for their health care. And so, you know, if we're continually borrowing from it, how do we ever know when we're actually in balance in that fund?
Well, Mr.
Are you talking paid back before the end of the fiscal year, June 30th next year?
Yeah.
Correct.
So the next administration is going to have to pay it back. The commissioner?
Oh, I was just going to, Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, when we move money from the Health Care Access Fund into the general fund, we have statutory obligations. We have the 30-day payment rule. We are making all the payments necessary and required in the Health Care Access Fund. And if there got to be a point where we couldn't, the Health Care Access Fund would take precedent, and we would use the short-term borrowing in the general fund.
I understand that, but I am concerned that we don't have a plan for ever having these funds repaid, period. This is troubling to me. I don't get to balance my budget that way.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if we're done with the health care, I wanted to go back.
I just wanted one other question. Are you on all other funds? I had one other question.
I was going to go back to the Minsky one, but I'll wait until we're
just
done with
health care. Just a quick question on all other funds. That money comes from, like, license fees and things, some of it. So we're taking money from license fees and using it to balance the general fund in some instances.
As an example.
Mr. Chair, everything that comes into the state, that comes into the statutory general fund, goes into the cash pool. So every revenue.
But temporarily it's being diverted to balance the budget. Is that a fair way to say it?
I would say temporarily it's being used to make our general fund obligations, to meet our general fund obligations.
Okay. Now, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, I indicated earlier I was just trying to get a clarification of those columns, but I did have some questions about Minsky in particular. And of that 539, the balance without actions, does that include tuition? Because in the fall of the year, they're collecting tuition, and then they make their payments until the next semester, and you're nodding your head yes. So then my follow-up question is...
Was that a yes, sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative... Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, that reflects any revenue that would be in Minsky's general fund as of August 31st. Now, my understanding is they're just starting to get their fall tuition in. So we would expect more of that to flow in September.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure when their tuition, Mr. Chairman, comes in other than fall semester has started. So I assume most students, although they can have a payment schedule, probably are going to pay most of it or all of it at the beginning of the semester. When we talk about special funds, the state universities operate dormitories, a couple of community colleges. Are you including the rents that they collect then from the dormitories? And then they have obligations if they've done any remodeling, you know, with their revenue bonds to make payments. So I'm just trying to get a picture of what's in the 539 and how that's going to work when they have to come down to 100 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I'm not familiar with that particular revenue stream and whether it goes into MNSCU's general fund or not. I can only say that we've reached an agreement with MNSCU that at the $100 million level for their general fund, we believe that that's a sufficient cash balance to make sure we're mitigating any risk as they're bringing in tuition and on the revenue side, as well as meeting their payment obligations.
And then, Mr. Chairman, going back to the tuition question, I'll at this point assume that it's just tuition there and that the dorm fees are a special fund within the system until we find out differently. But some of the campuses are more reliant on tuition than others. Others are more reliant on the state appropriation. Often it's coupled with size. I was up at Century College a while back, and the president up there said that they operate now about 65% to 70% of the Century College budget is tuition, the balance being state appropriation. Some of the smaller institutions that may be flipped to some degree. So who manages that within the system? Is that going to be the MNSCU board or administration, or do you look at each campus to decide what their cash balances will be? Because the central office has, some of us think, a significant cash balance, but it isn't anywhere near $100 million. It's usually in the neighborhood from 8 to 10 or maybe $12 million that they've maintained at the central office level. But the other pots of money are mainly on the campuses for meeting their needs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, we did meet with the trustees, the MNSCU trustees, to walk through some of the same information about a month ago, and we worked through Vice Chancellor Laura King, who is responsible for their financial matters.
So, Mr. Chairman, she will be the one that will be moving the dollars around within the system to make sure that those that would be more reliant, let's say, on tuition are going to be covered somehow?
I would assume at the direction,
you're collecting it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I would assume at the direction of the Chancellor and the MNSCU Board.
Okay, should we go to this chart now? So that's half the picture. That's a internal borrowing. Now we're going to go to some external borrowing.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Committee, I'll turn your attention to a spreadsheet called Cash Management Administrative Actions.
Like this.
This is for fiscal year 2011. If you recall, in July, at July's LEC committee hearing, we presented the same information. The beginning part of the spreadsheet is just our end of session forecast by month, our ending cash balance, and our monthly low point. That's our forecast. And then you can see the projected shortfall or low point. It's about four or five lines down, and it's highlighted. Essentially, what we're saying is we want to maintain around a $400 million balance in the statutory general fund. So you can see that we're below that even in September of 2010. October, November, December, and beyond. The next section talks about the administrative actions we plan to take. And when we came to you in July, we had a plan for doing that, but we had estimated numbers, and we've gone back to each of these groups or parties and revised our numbers with some additional information. So the first line under possible administrative actions is the K-12 payment deferral. This line that you see beginning in September would mean that we would borrow a total of $141 million from school districts beginning with the September 15 payment. That represents our best estimate of the maximum amount we can borrow under 127A 0.46. This will be 134 school districts will feel the impact of this borrowing. And the numbers are slightly different than what we showed you in July. MDE did a calculation of what they, given the variables in the forecast in terms of what can be borrowed, did an estimate, went to school districts, and said, here's what we think your cash balance from June of 2010 is. Let us know where we're wrong. And so that process took 2 or 3 weeks. And so they got back to us a couple weeks ago, and these are the final payment delays that we plan to implement, given our authority under that section.
Does that include the new allocation of education jobs dollars that has been
signed
up on?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Does that change these numbers potentially or not?
It may change those numbers. We submitted on a net basis. We submitted that education jobs application, I think, on the 27th, and we're awaiting approval from the U.S. Department of Education. And so once that happens, then school districts could presumably start to draw additional federal money.
So that may change, theoretically, that could change the numbers available here for borrowing?
That's correct.
Okay.
Make it higher.
We're just going to pass out, this is on the department's website, but this is the distribution to school districts. So, and I think we should publicly note that the executive branch chose what I think most people would consider the more fair distribution among school districts than the less fair. This is a broader distribution. They could have done it just on Title I, but the choice was to do it based on the formula, and that provides I think what most would consider a more generally distributed amount to everybody. So I think we should, I'm willing to recognize, or should, I want to recognize that the governor chose the fairest method to do it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, may I ask once again, how many school districts did you say 146 would be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, 134 districts.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Moving on to the U of M, under 16A, there's authority to delay 15% of the U's appropriation. In July, we talked about starting that in August and continuing in September. That's $89 million. We had some discussions with the U, and they were much more comfortable with us starting that delay in September after they had started to receive some of their tuition. So we pushed that back 1 month. Given those talks. We are also delaying sales and corporate refunds over $5,000 until January of 2011. Those numbers haven't changed since the last information we provided to the committee. And then we are also delaying capitation to health plans by two weeks. This is where DHS prepays for monthly service in the upcoming month, and we are and within our contract, we are able to pay health plans in the current month by the 14th of the month. So, for example, in September, we pay health plans for October service. What we're saying here is that we are not going to pay in September for October service, but instead pay in October for October service. We are able to do that until December, and my understanding is there may be some potential to do this again in 2011, but those contract negotiations are going on right now.
Berglund has a question.
Senator Berglund.
So, Mr. Chairman, does this leave any plan without adequate reserves?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, DHS has been working with the plans. There doesn't seem to be any substantial concern with the two-week delay, and we're not aware of any reserve issues.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask So the, oh, you're going to go to FMAP next, right?
Sure.
I'll let you finish that. I have
okay.
a broader question.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the FMAP extension, that is our best guess for how the state savings for the FMAP extension would apply to cash flow. So you're just seeing a straight $38 million impact to cash each month beginning in January of 2011. And then the bottom line, low point with actions. This essentially takes our end of session forecast, layers in all of the administrative actions we've just talked about, and you can see that in October, November are the first points this fall where we have, you know, concern about keeping that $400 million working capital target in the statutory general fund. And so the hierarchy that we're really thinking about is that we would first, like we've been doing, maximize the interfund borrowing, right? Second, implement these administrative actions. And then, as the commissioner said, to the extent that we still have problems, access the line of credit. Now, in October, it's not as simple to just say, well, it's $368 million as the low point. We're definitely going to have to access the line of credit. That's not true. Because if we look at our daily picture, we're only at $368 million for one day. So we really have to keep in mind the timing and how long our low points are going to occur.
Does that last low points with actions include all the interfund activity also?
Correct.
So in June, on June 656, is this all still interfund borrowed? We get to June 656. June 11th, 656. How much of this is still outstanding, the internal borrowing?
Where do you see 656?
Mr. Chair, can you repeat your question? I'm sorry.
You've internally borrowed from special revenue funds, MNSCU, healthcare access fund.
Mm-hmm.
And is that all paid back by June 11th, or some of that is still outstanding?
That's
when
June,
you're at the 656?
Oh, Mr. Chair, that would all be paid back by the end of June 2011. Yes.
No, June 2011.
Yes.
No, June 2011, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, he knows.
Oh, I'm looking at an old sheet. Apparently it's 886, not 656. Is there a newer number?
It's 886.
It's 886.
Okay. I'm looking at the old one.
We were confused with your numbers.
Okay, I was looking at an old one. Sorry about that. So you should have one that says 886 at the bottom. 886.
Correct.
And then one other clarification, Representative Coles. Is the intent when the allocation from the education jobs money is going to come in? That will be distributed to the school districts in their general fund. Will you then recalculate how much you can borrow and then go in and borrow, or not necessarily?
Mr. Chair, not necessarily. We really haven't had that discussion.
Okay.
It's possible, but...
It's possible, but...
Yeah, we haven't contemplated that. No.
Okay. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dibdahl, you mentioned the October number, the 368. You don't anticipate... needing to draw on the line of credit in October. Has the department figured out where it does anticipate needing to actually draw on the line of credit? I see the low point of, you know, negative 55 in March of 2011 and negative 20 million in April. Is it anticipated that in those months we'll actually need to draw on the line of credit? I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but can you just very briefly talk about how that line of credit is structured? How is it going to work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, a couple of things to keep in mind. First, the forecast will be very enlightening as to what happens next in 2011. We are currently running a positive balance in our collections. And we are also Ms. Cardell, who's been before you today, is in New York today pricing a refinancing of our debt and $900 million. So that might yield some savings in our in what we pay. We do that every year.
Was that the ad I saw in the paper?
Oh, that was for our bonds.
Geo-buddy.
Oh, okay.
That's so Sorry, people buy our bonds. So it's all to say that if we continue to collect more and we find ways to reduce spending, we might be able to avoid that through the end of the fiscal year, would be my hope.
So, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, just to – I want to make sure I understand what your testimony is. Is it the depart – I mean – Are we still looking at this line of credit as a contingency that we hope we don't have to exercise, that we anticipate we won't have to exercise, but we want to make sure it's there just in case? I applaud the planning. I think that planning is incredibly appropriate and important. But what's the department's best guess in terms of our need to actually go and access or draw from the line of credit?
All right. Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, my hope aside, if these numbers bear out exactly as you see them, we will have a likelihood that we may have to short-term borrow in December if it is indeed $190 million. You know, it depends, as Ms. Dibdahl says, and we can share it with you, but we have what the balance is by day and how long it is by day, and we won't make that decision until we get to December, and we will work with you when that does happen. I mean, if the numbers bear out as seen, we said we needed $400 million. The farther below the $400 working capital you are, the greater the likelihood is that the state has to draw on that short-term borrowing.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
On the short-term borrowing, what effect, if we do go into that option, and have you estimated if our rates will go up on GO bonds or anything else, and how will New York and Moody's and others look at us if they say, well, my gosh, you guys, you can't even balance your own budget, but now we're selling these GO bonds. Well, did you look at that? Do you think the rates might be affected by the $900 million that Representative Coles was talking about that was in the paper the last few days? Or don't you think it makes any difference? I would think it makes some difference. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, when we went to New York to the ratings agency visit in mid-July, we shared our plan for short-term borrowing, the $600 million. Essentially, the information we provided the LCPFB subcommittee on the budget. So they took into account our ratings, knowing this, you know, that we may need this short-term line of credit. And they had our updated cash flow projections that you see. You know, they were a little different then than they are today because we added FMAP and a few other things. But they were aware of all of this information when they rated the bonds and they were priced.
Just a quick question on that bonding thing. If a U.S. bank gives you a line of credit by the 17th, is there a fee involved?
We close on the 20th, and there is a minor. There is a fee, I believe. I don't have it with me.
What does minor mean on $600 million? Do you know? They're going to charge us something for just the line of credit, even though you don't use it, obviously.
And I'll get that to you. It's, you know, it obviously costs us more if we draw on it.
Okay. Anything else on cash flow, short-term borrowing?
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification on the question of whether we would recalibrate the delay, the K-12 delay. I am reminded that the authority to delay is based on June 30th, 2010 balances. So this new money really wouldn't impact school district balances at that point. So that wouldn't impact the delay.
Okay. Great. Thanks for that clarification. Okay, then let's go to Medicaid FMAP. We know about FMAP now. Is there anything else on that issue that we need to talk about before we do other federal grants? Anything else, Senator Berglund, on item 3, Medicaid FMAP?
No, I'm sure that we'll receive the money if the application went in.
Okay. Okay. Then other federal grants. We had asked...
Mr. Chair, just there is a estimated versus actual information on the statutory general fund on the back page. We don't need to go into it, but I just wanted to let you know we have that available, and we will, per Representative Solberg's request, provide that for the general fund as well.
What, just quickly, so the working estimate is lower than the actual. No, working estimate is above EOS estimate.
End of session.
What's end of session?
So we're actually better. Our working estimate is better than the end of session estimate because of the administrative options that we've talked about.
With the actions?
Yes. It just shows you the ebb and flow throughout the rest of the calendar year.
Okay. Great. So we had asked on other federal grants, what are the ones that are available? What are the ones that have been applied for?
And joining me...
What are the ones that are not being forwarded? Commissioner.
I'll turn that over to Commissioner Luna.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaker.
And we should, if it's something other than human services, we would want to know that too, if there are other grants other than human services.
Okay. I think as we explained to your staff, we don't serve, we meaning the Department of Management and Budget, as a central repository for, we don't have a standard list of every grant that's available. So when we got Matt and Bill's request, you know, I immediately emailed Commissioner Ludeman, the health, but I can do the others as well and try to coordinate.
Madam Speaker.
Mr. Chair, Commissioners, so who does serve as the central tracker? I guess we sort of thought maybe because you had done such a good job on the federal stimulus dollars that you were doing the same thing on these, but is the governor's office, is it someone else who's doing the central tracking of all grants available? You'd think that might be happening somewhere.
Well, on any given at any given time, there are literally, I think, thousands of federal grants across the entire department, and some that we don't even know about now. That, in the case that Commissioner Ludeman will talk about with healthcare, that are going to be coming out. We have tracked, as you've noted, and thank you for your comments, the stimulus, but I don't know what's coming out on the, on the PPACA, the federal law.
So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, so is that then done on an agency-by-agency basis for what might be available to do application for? It seems a little inefficient.
Well, what we do, Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, we use, before we can use the money, the money comes on the federal funds report and gets approved by the LAC. So we're not appropriating any money on the back end. I know you know that, but I wanted to make sure everyone else knows. It's a coordinating function, I think, on the front end that we haven't done. You know, normally, somebody in Commissioner Ludeman's agency will see a $500, or it could be as little as $10,000 grant being publicized somewhere, and they send an application in, and it comes in, and it ends up on a, maybe aggregated with some others, and ends up on a report. I guess what I'm saying is we haven't here, in the past, coordinated broadly searching out these grants in the past.
So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I guess that's an opportunity for a future administration to do something about, because it seems to me that this budget needs all the help it can get with partnerships.
Commissioner Lewin is going to talk about the health care and then separate health care reform from others. So I just wanted to follow up again on things that are outside of human services.
So you're...
will we know if some things are not being applied for?
Well, so what you want, just to clear the... communicate, I thought you just were interested in the human... the health, and but you're wanting the broad spectrum.
If there are other...
I will...
Ask the question.
Yeah, and I will farm that out to the other agencies, and we can collect the data and forward it to you.
Okay, great. Because I think the working presumption over the years has always been that agencies apply if they think they can be successful and they get the grant. And
right.
this year there's been a slight change. I'm just observing, not criticizing, that the governor is centralizing this, it appears, in his office. And that's fine. But at least we would like to know then if there are some, in addition to the human services, that are not being applied for. That's all. Okay.
So you want to know is the ones that we're not applying for rather than all of them?
What's available?
That might be easier
Well, I think all we're really trying to find out is what's
which ones are we not going to
ask? Yeah, in the past, we just assumed, you know, the agencies work for both the legislature and the governor, and agencies applied for things, and if they were successful, they got the money. In this instance, it appears that the governor is slightly altering that, and at least in human services, asking for that all to be run through his office. I don't know if he's asked to do that for other types of grants outside of human services, and I guess that's what I'm asking. Are there other types of grants outside of Mr. Ludeman's authority that are being reviewed and perhaps not applied for? So, okay, human services,
Mr.
Ludeman.
If I may try to help on that last
okay.
question. There was the governor's executive order applied to the Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act, of which in there are items that are not directly related to human services. So some workforce planning grants that came out of that act, the governor's executive order applies to that in front of you, I hope, by now. I'm sorry I didn't bring enough copies, but they're being they will be distributed.
So,
best representation of all the grant opportunities in the federal health care.
Okay, whether they're
reform.
Through your agency
That's
or not.
Exactly.
Oh, very good. Okay.
So
great.
There are schools that could apply for some of these grants. There are medical providers that can apply directly for some of these funds. Obviously, state government is often the key player in the application of these grants. And so to that degree, as you stated, the executive order is about those grants and the decision-making process. I've also distributed not only that, but one of the things that sort of triggered some of the first conversations is a letter that I've sent now to the healthcare chair people this morning relative to the healthcare exchange grant opportunities, the first healthcare exchange grant opportunities, which we have not participated in, and that deadline was last week. With that said, on the right-hand column, I think it is under a red heading in that handout that you either have in front of you or not, are the portions of the grants of which we interpret the special session number one by state law is mandating our participation in these grant applications. So you will see the six or seven categories that we believe mandate that we would participate or apply for these grants. The governor's executive order is explicit about that we will apply for those grants if we're required by law. His executive order also talks about his office being more directly involved in the other grant opportunities and whether or not they apply to the health reform, insurance reform, or other public health technology or other grants that no one would have problems with. With that said, Mr. Chairman, I'm at your I'd like to answer your questions rather than go through each grant. There's 108 or 109 grants in this.
Commissioner, not having had a chance to look at this, it looks like you folks have done a lot of work. Appreciate
yes.
that.
Yes.
Madam Speaker.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I'm looking at your letter. And I guess as a non-attorney around the table, I'm just wondering how long and how much time it took the attorneys to get to point one, which really seems just to be a circumventing of what the intent of the legislation was in the special session.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, that is the interpretation. I have to tell you that in when the special session one passed, this, for example, this part of what is called the planning and establishment grants weren't even contemplated to be available in September. And I can give you some chronology through our relationship with the White House, the HHS, if you want. The literal interpretation of one or more does not include first, every, and all. And so there are subsequent grant opportunities, much bigger than a $1 million grant opportunity for the planning and establishment of state exchange.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I think it's pretty clear to anyone who sat in those rooms and then slogged through reading every single word of that and the agreements that were made that this is certainly artful in its ignoring of what the intention was. And so I guess it's a heads up to all of you who will be here in the future to include the word all instead of one or more. So every time we learn something new, and we've learned something new, and that is that I bet attorneys spent a long time figuring out how to make sure that we wouldn't apply for these things and that we would lose dollars that Minnesotans pay in to their federal government. And I just think it's one of the, again, a lost opportunity that is unfortunate. I guess the question is, it's too bad that Representative Emmer isn't here. I would ask him if he plans on applying, if he were the governor of the state, for some of these dollars, some of these hard-earned taxpayer dollars that go into the federal government and then don't come back to Minnesota. And so I guess it's just, I think it's disappointing. So I'm just going to say that. I think it's disappointing when people use the words that we worked on together to not bring dollars home that both would create jobs in Minnesota and ensure that people had health coverage.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Just a clarification on that. Is the money we would be applying for money that's already been paid in, or is it increased debt at the federal level? It's money that the federal government doesn't have and would have to borrow or print.
Senator Olson, I think it's very clear that this was a balanced bill that Congress passed. They cut other things to be able to pay for these dollars. And so this is federal tax dollars paid in that are not coming home to Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, as I understand the executive order, I think the governor's saying he's going to take a closer look. I mean, I don't think he's saying he's going to turn down all of Commissioner Ludeman's grants. I think what he's doing is viewing it and making his determination whether it's in Minnesota's best interest. He's not saying I'm not going to apply for all of them.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Hansen. So I just want to understand this process. I'm not a healthcare expert. I'm glad Senator Berglund's here, and hopefully she can get into some of the details or correct me if I'm wrong on this. I want to know this process. You said that the governor is going to take a look at all these applications and then do what's in Minnesota's best interest. What does that look like? I mean, I'm assuming that for some of these grants, and maybe Commissioner Ludeman's better for this, I'm assuming a lot of work's been done on these grants, that taxpayer dollars have went into compiling the information and getting the application together. I'm assuming it's more than name of the state and how much money do you want and a signature. I think there's a lot of detail and time that has to go in involved in this. So a lot of taxpayer time and dollars are spent putting these applications together and then are getting stonewalled at the end. So how do we figure out, how does Governor Plante figure out what's in Minnesota's best interests on these taxpayer dollars? Can you describe the process, or maybe Commissioner Ludeman can help?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Sertich. I envision it to be somewhat similar to the LAC process on the back end, that type of information. I don't see it as any more of a drawn-out review. You have a process for reviewing federal funds when they come in. Sometimes you take a closer look and you have the full LAC meet. Sometimes you're able to sign off on it as a full report. I see it as the governor's office doing what you do, only more on the front end of the process.
Well, Mr. Chair, let's just take one, for example, that has been that Governor Plante's decided we shouldn't get our tax dollars back from Washington. Pick one. Which one do we want to use? Was there an abstinence one, Senator Berglund, that we lost $1 million of our taxpayer dollars? Where do we reject here? We reject Governor Plenty rejected.
Is there a column?
Here's one. The one that the business community wanted too, the health exchange. Let's use that one as an example. The federal health exchange, that we were going to get our federal taxpayer dollars back. Business community wanted this. Everybody wanted this to study if these health exchanges were a good idea. And maybe it's better, I don't know, Commissioner, I don't know if you're in the room for these decisions, but Commissioner Ludeman, you put this application on Governor Plenty's desk. Why was it not in Minnesota's best interest to figure out the health care exchange that the business community wanted, that the legislature passed, and that we set in law that we should apply for?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Sertich, there's a trajectory issue here about how fast any state needs to work to establish all the basis or the information needed to establish an exchange that is required by 2014. We have already done some of this work preliminarily 3 or 4 years ago. The fact that we don't even have the rules for what the main planning and establishment grants are not published by HHS. Our conversations with Nancy Ann Parle, the White House's health care reform, says we just want some investment so that we can learn from the states what an exchange would look like. When they fail to answer a question, would a Utah health insurance exchange qualify, or does it have to be a Massachusetts health care exchange? And they can't answer that question. We wouldn't even have enough parameters to do a lot of good work about what that exchange would look like. Any work that we've done on the preparation for this application is not lost. Every minute spent is a good investment for what would be a March 23rd deadline for the real planning and establishment grants of the health care exchanges. So this was just a preliminary assessment. It wasn't even a planning grant. It was an assessment grant opportunity of $1 million for every state and the District of Columbia. That is true. But this prior investment of those resources, federal taxpayer, your taxpayer resources to that, would end up with a result that would only help an application for a further planning and establishment grant. So we're planning to plan. And the governor believes and felt that this was not a worthwhile investment at this time for those establishments of an exchange, which may or may not exist in 2014, even though federal law says it may. There's a lot of controversy around the exchanges, how they would work. It's all based on the federal mandate, of individual mandate of every American having to be insured with appropriate penalties if you don't. There's no instruction, no guidelines about who's to assess that penalty. Is it the IRS? Is it state government? Is it the Department of Revenue? Who is to assess that penalty? And without it, that individual mandate, it is my belief, and I believe the governor's, that the entire health care reform unravels. And because that is what is the rationalization for the subsidies up to 400% of poverty through the exchanges. The fact that it would be a shopping mall or a marketplace for the individual and small group market is a good idea. But without knowing how much those subsidies are supposed to be assessed, who assesses the penalty if you don't have the insurance, these questions have not been answered. Almost every one of the 85% of these grants in this entire sheet have no guidelines. If you look at this sheet, it is only in that column where there is a blue website where the HHS has been able to develop appropriate guidelines for what these dollars will be spent for. I would remind you that the secretary is mentioned almost 2,000 times as a decision point on what is to be done next. And all that was the decision here was to make this $51 million available, $1 million per state for these assessment grants of a state exchange, without much more information than that.
Mr. Chair, and I'll have questions later, but I just want to end with, I think it's always in Minnesota's best interest, if that is the benchmark that we're shooting for here, to get our federal tax dollars back from Washington. We get 72 cents on the dollar back to Minnesota. There are a lot of questions hanging out there. I don't know all the details of all of this. Most Minnesotans don't. But what most Minnesotans know, and I think the governor has stated on occasion, is we should get our tax dollars back from Washington. And if there are questions out there, I don't care. We just want our money back in Minnesota. And when people go through the work of trying to figure this out, we should get our money back. And that's – I don't care if there are questions. I don't care if people – don't like the federal health care reform. We should still get our dollars back in Minnesota. That's very basic. So if this standard is in what's best for Minnesota, I think what's best for Minnesota is we get our money back.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. excuse me. In regard to the letter, I believe that the wording of the statute requiring the state to apply for health exchange grants in a number of one or more was used because we didn't know exactly how many planning grants would be available. And I believe we used the words one or more to indicate that we should be applying for all of them. And we believe that there would be health exchange grants available. Some of them might be planning grants, others might be operational grants, but that we wanted the state to apply for them, and that's why it was put in statute. Not to say, well, if we apply for one sometime before 2014, the law has been met.
Mr. Ludeman, did you personally think that this interpretation, didn't you think it meant all grants before this interpretation was developed? I mean, really?
Mr. Chairman, I was part of some of the negotiation of the bill, as the Speaker has alluded to. It was not my choice to say one or more, but I think the literal interpretation of one or more is what it is, one or more. We are obliged to apply for one planning and establishment grant, and we will do so. The deadline for this first assessment grant has passed us.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, I do want and hope you'll pass along my appreciation to our governor for actually looking at these grants and looking at what it would impose upon the people of the state of Minnesota. I do appreciate my colleague's zeal for wanting to get Minnesota's money back into Minnesota, but I do care how that happens. And if that means growing an ever larger government sector, if that means taking more money out of the pockets of our working men and women, then that indeed is not in our best interest, and we should be seeking other means by which we can get our tax dollars back. So I do appreciate the stance that the governor is taking.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and Representative Biskins, I think you make a valid point. The standard that we should take any and all federal money at every chance begs the question about what is it for and how is it to be spent. Often planning or assessment grants are what will lead states down the road to say we will oblige ourselves as well as a state to spend significant amounts of money. So knowing what you're planning for, we don't know enough about what the exchanges will look like, but it will probably oblige the states to spend significant amounts of more money, and if it is federal law, we will do so. If we make a decision to default to a federal exchange, as we did with the high-risk pool, that may be true and oblige the federal taxpayers to a significant amount of expenditure as well. It is not free money.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Sir. Mr. Chair and Commissioner Ludeman and Representative Biskins, if we were to apply that standard, one of the applications that were put in did have strings attached to it, and Governor Plante signed off on it, which means it's going to take more Minnesota tax dollars. Most of these right now that we were looking at that have been rejected have no strings attached to them, to my knowledge. I mean, we might think in the future something's happening, but you said it's planning money for planning money, so there's no strings attached there. One of the only ones that he's agreed to actually is going to cost us more money. Is that not true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Surge, the abstinence grant, that is true. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Ludeman, where are we getting that money from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Surge, you'd have to ask the Commissioner of Health. I don't know enough about that particular grant. It's through the Department of Health. I do need to say, though, you opened the door for us to say that there is not a lot of grants here that the governor has said no to. Anything required by state law is being applied for, has been applied for, or will be applied for.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, there's a big one out there, a $1.5 almost billion-dollar big one that I think we'll talk about a little later. So it's not the quantity of number of them. There's some big dollars out here, over $1.5 billion that hasn't been applied for yet. But is there somebody from the Department of Health here who can tell me where we're going to get this matching money from? Because I think this is where Representative Biskins and I frighteningly would agree. where are we getting this money from? I mean, we don't apply for the ones that is just our federal dollars coming back to Minnesota that the business community wants, that legislators bipartisanly want to figure out, but we apply for the ones that put us on the hook as a state. Is there anybody in the audience, or can we get that answer in the next?
Is there anybody from health here?
Or can somebody get somebody on the phone?
Should we send a letter over to them, or can we get that answer from you guys?
We can okay. Get you an answer.
Would you get back to Representative Sertich on that?
Thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's talk about some other grants through the Department of Human Services. What about the maternal, infant, and early childhood home visitation grants for 2010? Have we or are we applying for those? It's $100
million. Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, you're going to have to help me a little bit. There's
it's
a Department of Health one on page 4.
Of your handout.
The visitation program, the planning grant has been applied for. That is through the Department of Health, $1.7 million for fiscal year 10. That has been applied for, expected to be already here.
And the services to individuals with postpartum condition?
Madam, Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, unless it has... I'm not sure we've reached we don't even have a due date of the application.
So there is $3 million on the sheet for 2010.
Mr. Chairman, I knew this. If we were going to get this specific, we are going to get a loss. I have some information from the Department of Health. I have some of it from us. From the Department of Human Services. If you have issues of concern, I guess I will have to get back to you, Senator Berglund, about specific. I'll give you best of what I have, but that particular one does not show up on my radar screen.
Mr. Chairman, then.
Most of these, if they relate to public health or technology, the governor is certainly either allowing us to make the application or the application has already been made. And that fits a category of quite a few. Maybe I should tell you what has been applied for.
All right.
Maybe we'll do it that way, flip it up. And I'm not going to have the reference number. There's one called Strengthening Public Health Infrastructure.
Well, Commissioner, I think it might be quicker. Why don't we add a
column?
Could you people add a column and tell us which ones have been applied for and which ones have been rejected?
Yes.
And.
Madam Speaker.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I noticed that it seems a little incomplete on the funding opportunity dates because in certain cases, like the high-risk pool date, I mean, it would have passed, but it's not there. And so I'm just wondering how much other information is not included here about the date of when the grants are available and then, you know, so if we're going to update the sheet, let's update the sheet.
We will. Mr. Chairman and Madam Speaker, it's point well taken. This is about 3 hours old, this entire spreadsheet. So we will fill in every blank.
That'd be good. And I think I was just looking at a list that someone told me had not been applied for, and I was having a hard time finding some of them. So I think just a column that indicates either applied for, rejected by the governor, or no intent to apply for. I think those would be the three things that would be. Is that the three things?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Applied for,
not applied for.
Applied for, rejected by the governor would be a second column. And then thirdly, no intent to apply for. And there may be some like that.
Mr. Chair.
There are, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holbrook?
If I might, I think another important data element would be as if there's state money required to
Absolutely.
Be spent.
Absolutely. Is match money applied kind of for? There, Very good.
And then, Mr. Chairman, just to clear up your and my conversation from about 30 minutes ago, the governor's executive order just applies to PPACA. So I think, all right, so we're going to focus this analysis that you're talking about on that.
Well,
excellent. Senator Bergen.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, that's why I was referring to the two that I did. They were in the Health Care Patient Protection Act, those appropriations.
Yeah, they were.
Maternal and child health and home visiting.
So, Mr. Chairman?
If I can just do one more question, Mr. Sure. Chairman.
Senator Olson, on this point? Or
yes, on this point.
On this point?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, it does, in addition to the fact of the requirement of state funds, are any of these also carrying a maintenance of effort that once you are in it, you don't change or you don't go backwards at all? I mean, that's operational in a lot of federal ones, but in terms of any of these grants, if that is a factor, it would be nice to know that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, you make a real good point. Actually, passage of the federal law itself is established a maintenance of effort for us for the eligibility for medical assistance. So those income levels, for example, that you oftentimes see the federal poverty guidelines on MA eligibility will not be able to be changed through 2016. This is unrelated to the stimulus package, which has its own maintenance of effort, not only about eligibility, but product design or benefit set obligations, which we are locked into now through the end of our fiscal year 10 till July 1st of 2011.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and commissioners, there's just one other thing I'd like to clear up, and that is in regard to the medical assistance early expansion. Mm-hmm. And I want to make it clear on the record, because there have been statements made, I'm not saying they were made by you, but they've been made by others in regard to this, that this option for Minnesota is not paid for. That it would require us to come up with somehow, someplace, somewhere, some new spending dollars that were not accounted for in the last budget. And I want to make it clear that at least in my mind, it was paid for. I think the health plans are complaining that it was paid for, but they aren't actually on the receiving end of what was paid for. And so if you could please clarify that, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, you're correct. It's part of the, yes.
It's paid for. So it does not require any additional appropriation for the entire 3 years that the Medicaid early expansion would take place.
Right, and by the same token, if the next governor decides not to opt into the early enrollment, it saves about $360 million for 12 and 13.
Well, that would be if we decide to continue with the cuts that were made to pay for it.
Yes, exactly, yeah. But it's counted. I'm agreeing with you. It's counted.
I mean, our idea was we take the dollar from you, we send it to the federal government, we get the money back, we give you the dollar, and we give you the federal dollars back. Mm-hmm. And if we're not going to do that with that money, then we might not want to take your dollar away from you.
Commissioner Ludeman, you agree that it was paid for.
In a state budget sense, Mr. Chairman, it was. But it also said that it had to be paid for in the budget by new dollars, but that is for the legislature and the administration, that is a done issue. That it not be spent, however, would either save money or money that didn't have to be spent should we not early enroll. From an outsider, if I may, Mr. Chairman, they would say you paid for it in your state budget, but you didn't have to pay for it if we weren't going to do it.
Well, we did, and the bill was signed. We paid for it, and the bill was signed.
We did, but based on a contingency. And if that contingency isn't exercised, that money would not be spent.
Okay, but that's...
Mr. Chair.
But there was an agreement to do this.
Yeah, but what it means is the governor has signed the law. It is the law that we are obliged to... We have not spent the money, but we have paid for the cost.
Mr. Chair, and I think that's okay. I mean, governor can make his own decision to leave our tax dollars in Washington so somebody else can spend them. That's his choice. But I think the discussion, and I'm glad that the administration is on record publicly, because this has been a frustration of mine, hearing this debate about this MA option, this $1.5 billion of our tax dollars back to Minnesota. It seems to be some sort of debate still that if it's paid for or not. And I'm glad that you all are on record now so that this is not a discussion anymore and an opinion. This is a fact that it's paid for, that the only thing standing in the way of us getting our federal tax dollars back, 20,000 jobs, more insured Minnesotans, is a signature of a governor. And I disagree with the governor on this, but I'm not blasting him for it. It's his decision to make. I think it's incorrect, but at least there's not an argument of if it's paid for or not, because the political winds out there are, well, you know, there are some candidates saying we shouldn't opt in because it's going to cost our state more money. Well, we all know now for a fact it's been verified here at the table that's not going to cost a single cent more for the MA option because it was paid for in the last bill.
It will cost the state money. Now that we've already paid for it through a budget process is one issue, but it will cost the state to match those expanded dollars or those expanded coverage.
We haven't.
Using the word cost or paid for is a little bit of the semantic difference here. But it will cost us. We've already paid for it in the budget sense, but it will cost new dollars. It will cost at least $188 million.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, but the costs were covered. I think the discussion is people have been misrepresenting that it's going to take additional spending or cost or revenue of some sort, but it's right there in the budget, just like everything else. It's sitting there in the budget, and it's not being used.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sirdis, just to clarify, the $360 million that were needed if the next governor opts in for 12 and 13, that's included in, you know, our base budget. It's included in statute and would it's counted. Yeah. Whether the federal government's going to have the money, you know, that's an issue. I mean, there's that kind of debate. But I'm not saying that.
Commissioner Hansen, you're just applying for $267 million today. I didn't hear you fear that check's not going to come through.
Well, my point is that, you know, if you don't.
I think Commissioner, I just think that's just disingenuous in this one specific instance to question if the money's coming.
A better way to say it is if that commitment's going to be retained at that time. You're right. That's a better – is the federal government going to still do that and choose to do that is what I meant to say. That's all. I wasn't insinuating we were going belly up.
Okay. Mr. Anything?
Just a point of clarification, because this hits home kind of tough in some of the rural areas. I talked to the hospital administrator because we're talking with the client that's GEMC type of action at early enrollment, I believe. And their policy in Big Fork, which is kind of a little bit away from the metropolitan area, is they will continue to serve the people that they've had a relationship with. But anybody new coming into the system, they will go down, have to get down to the metropolitan area to find their health care. Now, how they do that or not. So there's a cost. Sure, it may be a cost to an individual that has an income of $4,000 to try to get the health care. But I want to just pursue one more question, if I may, and I know under the current law, the requirement is that the federal funds, that the information that you get be submitted by the agencies for permission to spend the money after you get it. And the federal application decisions were made at the agency level. Does the executive branch now intend to keep the legislature informed of the decisions that were made under this new process, at least under this specific thing for that? And will the legislature be notified of the federal funds? Now, I appreciate what you've done here, but will the legislature be also notified as we have in the past? Because usually before it was at agency to agency, which is the legislature to the agency.
We have asked for that. the Healthcare Access Commission is asked to know every grant that is available and every grant that's being applied for or not being applied for. So everyone else should be able to get that information also.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, I think the chairman's recommendation for the new three-pronged standard should answer that question very specifically and very transparently to the legislature. But you did remind me that some grant applications are agency choices not to apply for as well. So it isn't just the governor's no that governs this. There are many reasons, some of them of which we're not eligible for. I guess we could add that as a fourth category, Mr. Chairman.
Or it's not worth the effort because it's not enough money.
And that has been a standard for many years as well.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, I think anything. I just want to, on the health insurance exchange, the next executive can apply for that. There's another window, apparently, at some point.
Yes.
Don't throw away the application. Keep it in the file cabinet. So that's the one the chamber thinks we should apply for, I think, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, I think I just would like to say that one of the things that I think will be very important about the efficient operation of any health exchange that Minnesota would choose to set up is the eligibility determination for tax credits or eligibility for Medicaid or eligibility for some other health care program. We haven't had a real good track record so far in making those systems work, be up and running and working. And so I would think it would be in our best interests of trying to put as much money as we can get from the federal government into the planning for that part of the effort. Because if we're going to have one, it needs to be tested by the federal government in 2013, not 2014. And we need to have it up and running before they test it to make sure we know that it works. And I don't know that we're going to be able to get this eligibility part of this figured out in that length of time without the use of federal funding. I believe we should be starting now.
Commissioner, thank you so much. Commissioner Ludeman, thank you so much. Ms. Dibdahl, thank you. Appreciate it. Look, continued working with you.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.